This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Coming today, we will talk with Brian Check. He's the president and executive director of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. Brian Check will discuss why he believes global economic growth is contributing to biodiversity loss, climate change, and resource wars. Check is proposing an alternative economic model. And Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser will stop by to comment on the death of legendary political consultant Gus Weil, who died last Friday at the age of 85. And Lieutenant Governor Nungesser will offer his prescription for addressing Louisiana's deplorable roads. Abigail Gardner of the Value of Water campaign is slated to be with us to discuss the issue that involves infrastructure. She says Americans want federal spending on water infrastructure. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. And if you'd like to send an email, if you would like to, please do so at talk@talklouisiana.org. A reminder that coming today at 2 o'clock on WRKF, Governor John Bel Edwards will have his Ask the Governor show, his 25th program, and it's at 2 p.m. this afternoon. Ali Baltazar and Rebecca Dill are producing, and in studio to begin our conversation is Brian Check. He is the founding president and executive director of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. He served in the headquarters of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service from 1999 to 2017, and as a visiting professor in Virginia Tech's National Capital Region during most of that period. He's the author of several books, and he will be speaking today at 1 o'clock at Southern University at the Agriculture Center, and tomorrow he will be at Louisiana State University at 11:30 at the Dalton Woods Auditorium, the College of the Coast and Environment. And good morning to you, Brian Check.
Morning, Jim.
Now, you believe that we're doing a lot of things wrong as far as the economy and the environment, measuring those interests in our world. What can we do better?
Well, I think we have to face the fact that economic growth was a really good goal for most of the 20th century, but you can't grow forever, and there are so many signs that we are growing the economy too large for the good of the environment, the economy, the future economy, and frankly, national security and international stability.
Well, right now we have, of course, a lot of conjecture about what we're doing to the environment in the interest of the economy. Are the interests tilted to the capitalistic economic side more so than the environmental concerns?
Sure. I think it helps to recall exactly what economic growth is. It's increasing production and consumption of goods and services in the aggregate. And so that means increasing population and per capita production and consumption. So it's measured by GDP. And as that GDP grows, it does so at the, what we would say in ecology, at the competitive exclusion of non-human species in the aggregate. So it's a classic case of, fundamental conflict.
Yeah, you believe that global economic growth inevitably conflicts with environmental protection.
Yeah, I don't just believe it. I mean, it's based upon laws of thermodynamics and principles of ecology. It's just sound science.
You are proposing something called the steady state. What do you mean?
That just means a stabilized size of economy. You realize the economy can't grow forever. You can't have perpetual growth on a finite landmass. That would be the same as thinking that you could have a stabilized economy on a perpetually diminishing landmass. Mm-hmm. It's ludicrous. They're equally mathematically as ludicrous. Now, economic degrowth, of course, would not be sustainable either. That would be very traumatic if it happened very rapidly. So the key is the sweet spot in between there is a stabilized size of economy.
Now, Louisiana, we've been told for the last many years that we're losing a football field every hour. We know that economic growth is a contributor, that what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico is a contributor, and yet we allow this to continue. What mm-hmm. could be done to address this without disrupting the economy, or is that possible?
It certainly has been possible for decades now to move from the rapid growth path to a steady state economy and to prevent a lot of these disastrous types of environmental outcomes like sea level rise, taking that football field per hour of Louisiana coastline. But now it's getting to the point where we have to face up in this generation and the next few generation, unfortunately, for kids and grandkids, with some really hard reckoning about the size of the economy. And there's too much momentum now to prevent a lot of environmental disaster, but there's also enough time to prevent even much worse.
Brian Check is our guest for a few more minutes. Dr. Check will be appearing at 1 o'clock today at the Southern University Agricultural Center, and tomorrow he's part of the Supply Shock Economic Growth at the Crosswords and the Steady State Solution Seminar at LSU, 11:30 to 1:30, Dalton Woods Auditorium. Mike in Sherwood. Mike, you're on the air with Professor Check.
Hi, Professor Check. Your talk reminds me so much of the work Small is Beautiful by Schumacher, back in the 70s, I suppose it was, when he wrote that book. Why do you think the environmental movement has essentially failed? What happened? I'll take my answer off the air.
Oh, well, that's a fantastic question. If you had to summarize it in two words, you could say big money. You could also say political economy, to be a little more academic about it. But essentially, that portion of the environmental movement that focused on limits to growth, like Schumacher helped to do, has been squashed by big money taking its positions on the boards of the big conservation NGOs. And I know about this very well because I was gagged as a civil servant in the U.S. government. The politics in these federal agencies prevented civil servants like myself from helping to raise awareness of that conflict between growth and conservation.
When you say you were gagged, what happened?
I had written and verbal gag orders that prohibited me from speaking at all about the trade-off between economic growth and wildlife conservation.
877-217-5757, a bit more time with Dr. Brian Check, and he is appearing both at Southern and at LSU today and tomorrow, and he believes that there is a balance that can be struck, the steady state between the economy and the environment. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, gentlemen. Couple things. It looks that Europe has been really into this game a long time, and they did help that by putting a tax on gasoline, so you had to economize, and then they used that money for European infrastructure. And there are industries that are very profitable for renewable energy. A lot of countries are now doing a lot big percentage of their energy with renewables. I think big oil is our big problem. So anyway, thank you for your comment.
Well, thank you. It's very much the case that renewable energy is a step in the right direction. But the thing that we like to really emphasize at CASE, the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy, is that, you know, it doesn't really matter so much what the energy source is if your primary macroeconomic goal is growth, increasing GDP. You're going to at some point be pulling out all the stops, literally and figuratively, for that GDP growth. So you won't be able to stick purely to the renewable sources. You're going to be using, you know, clean coal, as they say, and dirty coal and tar sands, et cetera.
And I think I have given all different times for your LSU appearance. I said Friday once, and Thursday is Friday the 20th. So you will be at LSU Friday at Southern today, correct? Today. So Dr. Check will be here for a few days. a question from Kylie about why there is a continuing discussion about climate change. Is that something that should be settled, or is it an open debate?
A lot of the details, I think, are to be determined, but I think it's pretty well settled that the carbon and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are proliferating as a function of GDP growth.
Where do you think we're heading?
I think we're heading on a track on a runaway train, and the casualties mm-hmm. are mounting already. You have species that are going extinct or just barely perched in the tree of life at this stage. You have aquifers that will be gone in the next few, and so on. And so there will be casualties. The big hope, though, is that as we recognize that it's this pursuit of GDP growth that's causing these really tough problems, that the solution at least is pretty evident. And so moving toward a steady state economy. Mm-hmm. And, we're going to be sponsoring this legislation for the Full and Sustainable Employment Act to move the United States fiscal and monetary policy away from growth to a steady state.
And government has to play a role.
Yes. Theoretically, you could establish a steady state economy purely from the demand side by consumer reform, but I think realistically it takes both.
Well, once again, Dr. Brian Check will be at Southern University today, 1 o'clock at the Agricultural Center, and then on Friday, the 20th, he'll be at the Dalton Woods Auditorium, College of Coast Environment at 11:30, and this is a seminar, Supply Shock Economic Growth at the Crossroads. Thank you so much, Brian Check.
Thank you, Jim.
We'll be back after this pause with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Again, your numbers, 877-217-5757. Wherever you are, and if you're in Baton Rouge, you can save a few digits by dialing 297-5633. Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill producing, and our email is talk@talklouisiana.org. The Honorable Billy Nungesser, the Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana, is with us to talk about a few matters, and it is always a pleasure to share the microphone with one of the most enthusiastic ambassadors for the state of Louisiana. Good morning, Governor Nungesser.
How you doing this morning?
Doing well. And last Friday on this show, we told the world that we'd lost a Louisiana treasure in one Gus Weil, a political consultant who went back, about six decades. In fact, he started in 1958. That's exactly six decades. And if you wanted to be elected in Louisiana for many years, he was the go-to person. And, of course, he also had a great career as a poet, playwright, and host of Louisiana Legends on LPB and frequent guest on shows like this. But you knew him pretty well, didn't you, Billy Nungesser?
Yes, I did. I decided to run for state rep in my early 20s, after everyone else had their signs up, and he came to New Orleans and sat with me and helped me with my campaign. And I learned more from him about campaigning and the right way to do things that I've carried with me through to my successes today. And I saw a guy that really cared about his candidate and doing all the things to help him get elected, not just the commercials and really helped you understand the process and what was important to people as you went door to door, from learning the facts about the issues. A guy, a treasure that really cared about the people he helped. And that's not always true today in the political world. So he was a dear mm-hmm. friend and someone I looked up to.
And he was one of the last political consultants to work for both Republicans and Democrats. He worked both for Edwin Edwards and against him. And he was with your dad in 1983 when David Treen was running for re-election and lost to Governor Edwards. But he spoke very highly of both Governor Treen and your father, Billy Nungesser Sr. He thought that, for example, Governor Treen was the most honest public official he had ever met.
Absolutely. And, you know, when he talked about campaigning, one of the most important things he taught me was it's not what you have to say. You have to listen, and then you have to give solutions and real factual things that people can understand, but not just political rhetoric. And that's kind of not always the case today. For instance, we did a poll to see the biggest problems in Algiers. And before he had let me campaign, he took me to Baton Rouge, and we learned that at the time that he won tolls on the bridge. And he found out that was the most traveled bridge per lane than anywhere in the world. And we live in a free country. There ought to not be tolls. But you can't promise that because you're only one vote in 106. And, of course, all my opponents have promised that there would be no tolls on the bridge. So he had an approach, an honest approach about defending the issues, but learning about some facts that would help you better defend those issues. And that really stuck with me.
I don't think there will be another like Gus Weil, who spent 60 years providing advice of all kinds. And I remember that office he had on Perkins Road. And inevitably, when somebody would get in a pinch and have their name in the paper and have a crisis of some kind, a public relations fiasco, they'd walk up those steps and talk with the master. And he usually provided extremely good advice.
Absolutely. He will be missed by many people like myself, but Louisiana lost a treasure. And just a real good person that cared about people, and that's he was special.
I thought Mark Ballard did a good job in his obit in Saturday's paper about Gus Weil, but I commented, when you live to be 85 years old, quite often you outlive your contemporaries, and and 20 years ago, Gus would have been front page news, and now he was not. But for those of us who knew him, he was a force to be reckoned with and a true force of nature.
Yes, and like I said, there's 100 things that I carry with me today that I learned during that campaign, to be true to yourself and honest and don't stretch the truth, and just things that over my life have been so true that he instilled upon me in my first campaign. And actually, it was against 11 other people. It wasn't a Republican district, and I missed the runoff by 100-plus votes. Probably the best thing ever happened to me.
Well, it turned out okay for Billy Nungesser. Now, he encouraged candidates to be genuine, to be themselves, and that was in evidence when he helped get John Julian McKithen elected governor of Louisiana in 1964. McKithen was exhausted when he was cutting that campaign spot that is now the stuff of legend, and he said, instead of, "Won't you help me?" he's, "Won't you help me? Won't you help me?" And Gus decided to go with it, and that became something that is, as I said, it is legendary, that particular commercial. "Won't you help me?" Beat Chep Morrison when you and I were little kids in New Orleans.
Yep, yep.
Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yeah, so Lieutenant Governor, do you agree with Gus Weil's very negative views about Donald Trump and David Vitter?
Well, I don't remember his comments about him, so it's hard for me to comment on it. You know, let me tell you, there's good and bad about all that we can talk about the elected officials. I don't agree with anything anybody does, but I don't remember what his comments were, so I don't want to comment on them. I just really wanted to honor a man that I thought the world of today.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have been quite active in trying to create a relationship with Governor Edwards, who is going to be on the show today for his monthly show, Ask the Governor, 2 o'clock. But some Republican lieutenant governors, if they held that position, would be on his one-yard line criticizing him daily. You don't do that. Why?
Jimmy Fitzmaurice sat me down before I ran and said, "I'm going to help you because I believe in you." He says, "But there's two things you got to remember. You can't criticize the governor, whoever it is, and you got to tell him you're not running against him." And I said, "Governor," I called Jimmy Fitzmaurice Governor. I said, "Governor, why?" He says, "The only way you can do your job that the people elect you to do is if you have a working relationship with the governor." And And he was absolutely right. As you look back at governors and lieutenant governors, some of them that didn't talk, the governor has been very gracious in allowing me to do things when he can't be somewhere. We entertain some people from Taiwan and China, business people. He can't be everywhere, and I have the opportunity to help out in those aspects, as well as his support on the foundation, which is going to raise money and hopefully make our state parks self-sufficient. That wouldn't happen if I didn't have a good working relationship with the governor. And as Jimmy Fitzmaurice said, the people elected me to be lieutenant governor, not to look at a next political move, but to do the job I was elected to do. And I have had a good working relationship with the governor, and he has helped the tourism office. His wife has been very instrumental in the arts that is so important across the state. And so, yes, absolutely. We help each other out where we can, and where we disagree, we'll talk in private about it. And I'm not short on giving my opinion, but we both want the best for Louisiana, and that's what I'm elected to do.
And we're going to spend a bit more time with Billy Nungesser and get his take on his proposal, an innovative one, on how to address the road issues we have in Louisiana, which we know are substantial. Before we go to the break, though, Sarah says she didn't know Jimmy Fitzmaurice was still alive. And, oh, yes, he is. He is still alive and well into his 90s, but quite a survivor, Billy Nungesser.
He's a great man, and he loves his state. And he was an ambassador for Louisiana every morning. He got up, and he still is. I still take advice from him. And matter of fact, I owe him a call to go have another cup of coffee with him because he has been a mentor of mine and surely a close friend.
We'll be back after this pause. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. It's always a pleasure to share the microphone with the Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana, Billy Nungesser, who, of course, was president of Plaquemines Parish when we had the Deepwater Horizon tragedy 8 years ago. And hard to believe, Billy Nungesser, that in 2 days we will be noting the eight-year anniversary of what was the greatest natural disaster of its kind in the history of our country.
Wow, I know. It pops up on us every year, and we forget what we went through back then. And the good news is every year it's getting a little better, and things are coming back.
You had to endure some real challenges during that period, and I'm sure some of them are vivid to this day. What was the biggest challenge?
Well, the biggest challenge was getting the federal government to understand Louisiana. And, you know, when the president came down and they had rejected building the berms, and he walked in the room and said, Billy, I thought we were on the same team. I said, we are, Mr. President. I asked Thad Allen to resign. He's not listening to us. And he sat down and he agreed to send the team back to reevaluate the berms and give us his answer in 3 days after that meeting. And 3 days after that meeting, he called the governor and said, we're going to build the berms. And when he left the room, he turned to me and said, Billy, now we're okay. I said, yeah, Mr. President. He said, well, call me before you call Anderson Cooper. So, Mr. President, I don't have your number. He said, well, give the parish president my number. And Bobby Jindal leaned over and said, I don't have that number. I said, don't worry, Governor, I'll give it to you later. But that was a defining moment that we were able to get to the president, have him reconsider building those berms. Of course, they took too long to build them, but they did keep oil out the marsh. We tried to convey early on that we could pick up the sand, well, off the sand, but we would never pick it up out the marsh, and we were right about that. And from day one, the federal government did not understand that.
I mentioned today, Governor, that you have a plan that you have touted, and it's an innovative plan, I think one worthy of discussion, and there are a few different ideas on how we resolve our road conditions, but you would, based on your proposal, this would involve all the traffic that goes in and out of our state from other states, and we know it's immense. The people who do the traveling through Louisiana, and of course, in many cases, tear up our roadways, they would be on the hook for the work. How would this work?
Yeah. Well, it was just an idea. You know, I get a different idea every day. Some of them are horrible, But I think if we throw them all out there and let the best ones become reality, it was just an idea whether it was legal and ethical for us to put, say, a 10 cents or whatever, a tax on the gas. But at the end of the year, if you're a Louisiana resident, you could turn in your receipts and be reimbursed for that extra tax that would be on gas here in Louisiana to help fund the and that way it would not be a burden on Louisiana taxpayers, but everyone that travels through. I don't know if that's a good idea or a bad idea, but it was just something I've discussed with some of the elected officials to look for some way to take care of all the infrastructure problems we're having. You know, another thing, I'm trying to get a bill passed to create a scratch-off, one for our vets, our seniors, and our special needs children. But I'm having difficulty because, you know, we told them we'll take the bottom three scratch-offs. We don't need any advertising money, and we'll guarantee the lottery what they brought in last year and let the money go to those groups. Nobody walks in and buys a scratch-off and says, I'm here to help education. We took the education money for something else, filled it with lottery money. No teacher got a raise. Education didn't get better. So nobody buys a lottery ticket to help education. In Texas, a scratch-off brought in $30 million for the vets. If people knew the money was going to the greater cause of special needs children, seniors, or vets, those three lottery tickets, I believe, would outsell any of them. But we're having a little difficulty because change, and I think the lottery board and people does not want I think we do great with it and help a lot of needy people.
All right. Well, I guess the question would be why go toward the lottery, which does provide a lot of money for state government. There are other entities that could be used for the same objective. But getting back to the road issue, when I travel I-10 and I-12, as I do frequently, and I'm sure anybody who lives in Baton Rouge does, when you get on that interstate, it is just a flurry of 18-wheelers zooming by in all lanes and filling up the roads. And I would guess, Billy Nungesser, that most of those traveling through Louisiana are probably from out of state. And they are using our roads, and because of the weight causing the roads to diminish, why not find a way to tax those who are coming through our state and make them pay the freight?
Yeah. You know, I think it's something, you know, we failed to raise the gas tax and in the last session, and it's just an idea that maybe would lessen the burden on Louisianans. And, you know, I talked to Sean Wilson about it and some of the legislators, and, you know, it may be a bad idea. I don't know. I just think that the roads and the conditions of the bridges are in terrible shape. We've got to do something, and we got to think outside the box.
Well, Governor, it is always a pleasure to talk with you, and let's do so again soon. Thanks for stopping by today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, my friend. Bye-bye.
See you soon. Billy Nungesser. Our guest now is a lady who is involved with a major issue in our world, water. And this is something that I think many of us probably take for granted. We live in Louisiana, but a new poll shows that 88% of Americans want federal spending on water infrastructure. And with us to talk about it is Abigail Gardner. She is slated to be with us in just a moment. She is with the Value of Water campaign. And as we know, water is the thread that weaves together our daily lives, essential, reliable, invaluable. It keeps our community is healthy and keeps our cities running, our economies growing, and in some parts of this country, it is as important as the roads conditions that we're talking about here in Louisiana. Americans support rebuilding America's infrastructure more than any other element of the current administration's agenda, and 88% of Americans, 55% strongly support increased federal investment in water infrastructure. Abigail, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Jim. Thanks for having me on today.
Well, why do you believe this is essential to the stability of our country?
Well, water fundamentally is essential to everything we do, and whether that's turning on the tap to brush your teeth in the morning or flushing the toilet, or if you're a brewery, a pharmaceutical manufacturer. You know, water touches everything in our lives, in our businesses, in our economy, in our community. And too often, I think we take for granted all of the elements of the infrastructure we can't see, the pipes hidden under the streets, the water treatment plants out of the range of where most people spend their days. But the truth is, a lot of those systems have been operating for 50, maybe 100 years, depending on where you are in the country, and the bill is coming due. It's time for an upgrade. So that's one of the key things we're talking about this week during Water Week, and one of the key findings in our poll is that people understand and appreciate, if they know that there's potholes on their street, or they know that their highway system or their bridges or their tunnels are aging, if they can kind of understand and appreciate that their water infrastructure is in the same place, and it's really critical that we invest in it.
Well, the price tag given for doing this effectively is about $1.3 trillion. That's a lot of money. But you say even when Americans in a survey are informed of the cost, they're still supportive.
Yeah, that's right. And we were a little surprised by that. We asked the questions a few different ways. If we don't tell people how much it costs, if we do tell people how much it costs, does it change how in favor they are of investing? And surprisingly, it didn't. Whether we're talking about people being willing to spend more on their personal water bills, or they'd like to find a different way for their local or state government to pay for it, or, you know, a big message this week is to tell the federal government that we also need a strong partner at the federal level, that realistically all of these investments cannot be handled just by individual ratepayers and local governments and even state governments. With mm-hmm. such a big price tag, we really do need a strong federal partner to be at the table and invest the way we really need these systems to be invested in across the country.
Well, some of the numbers are staggering. 1.7 trillion is the number of gallons of drinking water we lose every year to faulty, aging, or leaking pipes. And 237,000 is the number of water main breaks every year in the U.S., 700 a day, one almost every 2 minutes. 47 years is the average age of our pipes, and in urban centers, they're older. Philadelphia's average 78 years, New York 76 years. And the grade that U.S. drinking water and wastewater infrastructure received from the American Society of Civil Engineers is a D. Why are we not more alarmed?
Yeah, I mean, when you list all the numbers like that, it's pretty stunning, isn't it? I go back to the fact that I think a lot of it is out of sight and out of mind. And as long as you turn on the tap and water comes out, you don't smell anything weird, there's no odd color to it, you flush the toilet, water goes away. It's very easy for Americans to just take it for granted. It has been there for us. You know, people of my generation, of older generations, we can't remember a time without reliable water infrastructure, drinking water and wastewater service in our country. But, mm-hmm. you know, the truth is there are communities around the country that do not have reliable drinking water service or wastewater service. And those stories are really starting to bubble up. The nation reacted very strongly to Flint, and even though it's not in the headlines on a daily basis quite the way it was a year or two ago, I do think there is a major change in public perception about how vulnerable we are if we don't take care of our water infrastructure systems. I think people saw from Flint that it's a public health and public safety crisis.
And you can go to thevalueofwater.org or waterweek.us to find out more. Thank you, Abigail Gardner. This is Jim Inkster, and we're pleased now to be joined by one of America's top public speakers, Clint Arthur. His previous works have included 21 Performance Secrets of Donald Trump, and his latest is Speaking Game. And it is always a pleasure to talk with somebody who talks for a living. Good morning to you, Clint Arthur.
Good morning, and thank you so much for inviting me on this show to help your audience, whether they're moms at home or employees working jobs or small business owners. Anybody, whoever opens their mouth to say anything, is going to benefit from this interview, because this is all about how to have more fun, make more money, conquer any fear you might have of speaking in public, and to do it all by just playing a game when you speak.
When you say playing a game, what are you talking about, Clint?
That's the speaking game. The speaking game is something I invented to help my students become better speakers. And what it's all about is using various tricks and techniques to make speaking more fun. One of the very simplest ways to play the game is to change your volume. So sometimes you're going to speak really loud, and sometimes you're going to speak really soft. And then you speak louder and softer and louder again. And when you do that, when you make the change between loud and soft, you get 1 point in the speaking game. That's pretty easy, right?
Well, you make it sound easy, but 75% of the people who have been surveyed say they have a fear of public speaking. Why is that the case?
Mostly because they have said something in public or in a group and it didn't work out, and they don't want to look stupid or silly or not smart. Everybody is so concerned about looking good. That's why Facebook, the life that you lead on Facebook may not actually resemble the life that you actually lead, but you put on the better face, and that's why social media is so popular, because you get to look the way you want to look on social media. And when you're speaking live in the moment, you have an opportunity to make a mistake and therefore not look good. And what I'm saying is, it matters far less what you actually say if you just say it in an entertaining way. So, for example, another way that you can earn a point when you're playing the speaking game is to change your volume. Sometimes you're going to speak really fast, and other times, maybe like in Louisiana, you'll speak a little slower. And when you change it up by going faster or going slower,
okay, well,
boom,
we got that. What about appearance? Should a person look a certain way?
Costume is an essential element of making the impact and having the influence that you want to have. If you are going to be a successful executive in a corporation, you are most likely going to wear one particular kind of costume. However, that same costume wouldn't do so well for you if you were going to be working in a circus or working on a riverboat. It all depends on the circumstances. It has to be an appropriate costume for your job. But 100% yes, and I believe that color is a very important element for that. Celebrities, and really my whole career is about helping any kind of author or speaker or entrepreneur or small business person become a celebrity in the eyes of their customers and prospects. And really, celebrities understand that using bright colors to help you stand out helps you to make more impact and get people's attention when you speak.
Well, the latest work from Clint Arthur, our guest, is Speaking Game. His previous works include 21 Performance Secrets of Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is a remarkable performer. Do you think that's why he won the election in 2016?
Donald Trump is one of the four presidents that I have identified as an entertainer in chief. Those included Ronald Reagan, who was obviously a movie star, advertising pitch man, great entertainer, and great president. Then there was FDR. He was the most famous radio star in the world with his Fireside Chats. Those Fireside Chats were the most popular radio show in the world at the time when radio was the most popular form of entertainment on the planet, and FDR was the producer and sole performer on the Fireside Chats. He was obviously a great entertainer and a great president. And then Abraham Lincoln was another one who was an entertainer-in-chief, a motivational speaker along the lines of Tony Robbins, if you will. However, Lincoln was trying to motivate people to lay down their lives for the idea that all men were created equal, and his speeches were made to motivate people on bloody battlefields. So what a powerful entertainer he truly was. Today, even the lines from his most famous speech are known by little children, even today, 47 years ago. Everybody knows that line. That was a Lincoln piece of entertainment. So Donald Trump's ability to entertain and mesmerize and have people have fun at his rallies and watching him on television is one of the big, big reasons that he has been elected, and now he holds the most powerful office in the world.
I watched him the other night speak for 75 minutes in Pittsburgh in support of a candidate who did not win, but he did go on for 75 minutes, and he had the audience in his grasp. He also denigrated a lot of people in that speech, including Oprah Winfrey and Chuck Todd, called him sleepy-eyed son of a bitch, Chuck Todd. Is that, you're laughing, but is that an appropriate way to utilize the great gifts that Donald Trump pass?
Donald Trump understands that the most important job of a speaker is to entertain the audience. In order to lead an audience, you must engage them. And the first step of engagement is to have their attention, and attention comes from entertainment. So he says a lot of things that are intended to shock, are intended to captivate people's attention, maybe get them mad, maybe make them laugh, maybe get them excited. And all of it is calculated by a master. We're talking about a man who was paid $1 million to be a speaker at events while he was just a private citizen. Think about the contrast between that and Bill Clinton, who allegedly received $500,000 as part of a corruption thing for uranium from the Russian government. He only got paid $500,000 as part of his corruption.
Here's now, wait a minute. There has been no proved corruption involving that uranium deal. That's a myth.
I said allegedly.
Okay, well, that was irrelevant to this conversation. But Donald Trump the other night, he said that the stock market was up 40% under his watch. It's not up 40%. It's up above 20%, which is great. But why does he have to exaggerate?
Oh, I'm not a fact checker, and I'm not here really to make political statements about Donald Trump or the way he does things. I think that everything he does is intended to captivate attention and get media attention. That's really what his primary aim is. Remember, we're watching the Donald Trump reality show, and what is a show all about? Ratings. How do you get ratings? By being entertaining. Remember when Honey Boo Boo had a show? That certainly had a lot of unusual language and sometimes offensive material and also shocking stuff on it, but nobody seemed to get upset because she was just a little girl. Well, it's all just TV entertainment.
Well, sometimes people can be captivating public speakers and not exaggerate and not attack people. I thought President Obama, for example, was a good public speaker. How do you compare him with Donald Trump?
That is a tremendously interesting comparison because they could not be more different in any scale. They were completely different types of performers. Obama's performance is all about his intellect and his ability to portray the image of calm, cool, collected maturity. And it's a very powerful method of oration. And even despite the fact that he's more of an orator than he is a speaker or somebody who gives talks, he still is able to bring in a folksy, down-home kind of presentation. He's a master. He's a master communicator, and nobody would ever dispute that. Trump has his own way. You know, Trump is a hard-scraping New Yorker and reality television star, and he has a way of captivating attention not just here in this country but around the world. And if you were to put the two side by side in a ratings face-off, I think his brand of in-your-face, outspoken attention-grabbing would probably get higher ratings than Obama. And really, look, this is really all about how can a person go into a PTA meeting and get more of what they want out of the meeting? And I'm saying if you use some of the methods in the speaking game or even some of the methodologies that I wrote about Donald Trump in 21 Performance Secrets of Donald Trump, you will get more attention, and therefore, you will get more of what you want. And hopefully, that'll be used for the purposes of enhancing the world and making it a better place and helping you to live a happier, fuller life with more fun and more money.
The book is The Speaking Game from our guest, Clint Arthur, who, as you can hear, is a captivating public speaker in his own right. And, Clint, it's a pleasure to spend time with you. Thanks for joining us. And a reminder that coming today at 2 o'clock, another captivating speaker, Governor John Bel Edwards, will be with us for Ask the Governor. So if you have a question for the leader of Louisiana, this will be his 25th program since he started in April, right after he was elected, and it took the oath of office in January of 2016. He began doing his show, and he's the first governor since Mike Foster to do this. And we commend the governor for joining us, and we'll spend some time with him 2 o'clock this afternoon right here on WRKF. Certainly want to mention the loss of Barbara Bush, the former First Lady, both wife and mother of a U.S. president. Only Abigail Adams was in that company with Barbara Bush. She died yesterday, age 92, a long and productive life, and her husband is alive. He will be 95 on June the 12th, 94 rather. And we lost Carl Castle, the Peabody Award-winning broadcaster for National Public Radio, a fixture on Morning Edition, and wait, wait, don't tell me, Carl Castle died yesterday, 84 years old. For Allie Baltasar and Rebecca Dill, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.